Hello everyone, and welcome to yet another exciting episode of our podcast, Books and Beverages. My name is Fred Kumalo, editor of City Press Voices, under which the podcast is broadcast. Now in the studio today, we are joined by the illustrious novelist, academic, short story writer, playwright, and many other things besides, which things we shall speak about. And he'll have to take some tough questions about the other thing that I haven't disclosed yet. The name is Dr. Sipiwe Maclory Mahala. Welcome to City Press Books and Beverages Show.
Thanks, I'm doing well. Well, I suppose I'm the cheapest date you've had on the show. Because the only beverage we have here is a fruit juice, which is very much appreciated. Great to be here, finally.
Thank you. As the name says, books and beverages. So what we normally do for those of you who are joining us for the first time, we invite writers and we ply them with beverages of the stronger kind. But of course, Dr. Mahala doesn't touch the stronger type of drink. So we had to downgrade, you know. And so we've supplied him with some fruit juice.
I'm a cheap date, I understand.
So as I said earlier, our illustrious writer in studio today is well known because he writes, as I said, across different genres. Before we get to the serious stuff, now we get to the question or the issue that I alluded to earlier. Such an illustrious man, such a super achiever, just happens to be a supporter of a failing soccer team, Kaizer Chiefs. I mean, how do you reconcile the two? I mean, an intellectual who supports a Kaizer Chiefs, what a contradiction. Come on, you must upgrade to the...
This is very unfair. But all the progressive thinkers should support Kaizer Chiefs, because from the beginning, the founding of the club, was quite a revolutionary act. And we continue when they think we go on, we get up,
on penalties.
10-1-1 is going to rise again. In him we trust.
Yeah. Thank you. Now, on a more serious note now, let's talk about, this man's journey is varied and very long. So I don't think we can exhaust everything in 30 minutes that we have at our disposal. So we're going to ask him to talk us through two major projects that are currently the talk of the town. The one is the play, the stage play, about Block Modisani and his American friend, Langston Hughes. And the other, of course, is the ambitious biography of the literary and journalistic icon Ken Temba. They both were released this year. Tell those of our listeners who are not familiar with who Ken Temba was, what he means to local journalism and the world of letters, and what this book that you've written seeks out to do.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Well, first of all, I've had a relationship with Ken Temba since 2002. So it's been 20 years. My attraction to him was obviously the story, The Suit. And in 2002, I wrote The Suit Continued. So, I discovered at that point, because after writing The Suit Continued, that there wasn't much written about him as a person.
Yes.
Yet, whenever we talk about the history of journalism, particularly, what we'd call black journalism in South Africa, Ken Temba is always mentioned there, because the drum period, the 1950s, drum having been found in 1951 as a magazine that targeted black readers. So it was a defining period in South African journalism and in the cultural space as well. you know, but to my disappointment, that there was no definitive study on Ken Temba.
Yes.
You know, there was
him
no,
as a person and
him
also
as
his
a person.
And also his contribution.
Yeah.
The analysis of his contribution. Yeah.
Well, there was mention here and there, but there was no focused study on him.
Yes.
You know, so I started, you know, talking to people who had known Ken Temba personally. You know, I had interactions with the likes of Louis Ngosi, Eskia Mpahlele, and I worked very closely with Brawili.
Mm-hmm.
So it was after the
Brawili is Khosisile.
Yes, that's right. Okay. I grew up as Khosisile.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was after the passing of Ngosi in 2010 that I realized that, you know, all of the stories that he was sharing, the anecdotes that he was sharing, I never recorded. And I realized that many other people, you know, who knew Ken Temba were going and without us recording those stories. So I started speaking to people like Nadine Godima and Dade Don Matera, and basically one interview led to the next. And at the end of the day, I had done about 30 interviews or so.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I then pursued that as a scholarly study.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, how I got my PhD, graduated in 2018.
Yes.
And then my PhD won an award to be converted into a book, the NIHSS award. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be just copy and paste. But writing a book was a whole, you know, different kettle of fish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took a lot out of me, and I must say, I doubt I would have finished it on time if it was not for the lockdown. Because
okay.
for the first
okay.
time
okay.
In my adult life, I was sort of. I had a certain level of control of my schedule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I worked from home. I could work throughout the night and then go to bed when other people are getting ready to wake up.
Mm-hmm.
So the lockdown really allowed me space to work on so many projects, including Bloke and his American Bantu.
Right, right. But there's another very important work that speak to the legacy of Ken Temba, which we haven't referred to, The House of Truth. Tell us about that, the stage play.
Yeah, The House of Truth is an offshoot of my academic research.
Mm-hmm.
You'd recall at the time I was working for government on the one hand, and on the other pursuing an academic project. The two combined are quite toxic. So I needed an outlet. I needed to find something else to do, you know. So as I was doing the research, I could see Ken Temba's life unfolding right before me.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a play, which was my first professional play, called The House of Truth, and got Brasilo Maikangube to perform it. And it premiered at the National Arts Festival in my hometown of Makanda in 2016.
Mm.
Yeah, and then had a national tour, which was quite successful.
Yeah, I watched it at the Market Theatre. It was really, really scintillating. Asilo was in his element, at the top of his game. It was wonderful.
It was quite exciting because Brasilo had... performed the very first adaptation of Ken Temba's The Suit.
The Suit, yes.
So I approached him not to perform the play because I thought, being such a seasoned actor, he wouldn't want to act in a play by a novice.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted his opinion on the script.
Yes.
And when he said, I can act this thing, I was like, what?
Yeah.
So it was much more than I bargained for.
Wow. And that set you on your way to give you the confidence to write plays.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, writing plays is something I studied plays at school. And I grew up in Makanda watching plays. And going to the National Arts Festival, I always had this vision that, you know, I want to be more than what my peers were. I want to be more than what my father was to the National Arts Festival. Because, you know, the locals at the National Arts Festival at the time would either be security guards, car guards, or busy at the gate with ticketing. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be part of a production, you know. So having been attending the National Arts Festival since 1988, for me it was the defining moment, my life sort of came full circle when I went to the National Arts Festival to headline the festival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've done that twice.
Yeah. Kudos to you. Now, Blok Modisani, people who are not into journalism or history might not know who this person was and why his name was so important. Could you tell us about him and the play that you have written about his career and relationship with the American poet Langston Hughes?
Yeah, I have obsession with the lives of journalists because they document life, and in turn I try to document them, just like Ken Temba. Mm-hmm. Blok Modisani, I had that particular interest in him because, at least unlike Ken Temba, he managed to document his personal life in his autobiography, Blame Me on History.
Yes.
But Blok was born in Sofia Town. He worked for Drum. He joined Drum, I think, in 1954, just shortly after Ken Temba. And, you know, while working as a journalist, he was also fascinated with films. Actually, his own name, Blok, was taken from a film. And he started acting just before he left. He featured in Ethel Fugard's No Good Friday.
Yes.
He was part of the original crew. You'd recall later on, Louis Ngosi would act in the same play. But he also, together with Louis Ngosi, they have writing credits in Comeback Africa.
Comeback Africa.
Yeah.
Featuring Miriam Makeba, yeah.
Ken Temba, and the two of them,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
So, but whilst Blok was more well-known as a journalist in South Africa, when he went to England, where he was exiled, he became more well-known as an actor there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he featured in a number of plays, one of them being Blacks in London. He featured in a number of films in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
He appeared in he wrote over 20 radio plays for the BBC.
Mm.
And he featured in BBC more than 40 times, know. So he on the one hand, he wrote radio plays, but on the other, he also acted in some of the plays, radio plays.
Sure.
So that's the person we're looking at. But the interesting thing, or what I found most fascinating for me, was the relationship he struck with Langston Hughes. I came across their letters in the U.S., between 1960 and 1967, they exchanged over 50 letters. And Langston Hughes, I mean, had been corresponding with so many people all across the world, from Nnedi Azikiwe to Leopold Senghor to Chinua Achebe to Eskia Mphahlele, Todd Matshikiza, many people. But having gone through all of those letters, I felt like he had a much more intimate relationship with Blok Modisani.
Mm-hmm.
And this is seen, you know, the kind of details that they share and how much when Blok sort of disappears for a week or two, Langston gets so frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
He misses this man, and you know that they gave each other terms of endearment. They would call each Blok would call him my American Bantu, and Langston would call him my favorite Bantu.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
So they had that kind of relationship where they exchanged gifts, stories, gossip, and I thought, you know, I find that quite fascinating, the relationship. but also the idea of celebrating friendship between men and men is something that hasn't been done.
The brotherly love.
Yeah, yeah, the brotherly love that they had, you know, was really, really amazing for me. Yep.
Right, right. So the play, I saw the iteration that was performed at the UJ, University of Johannesburg, and subsequent to that it went to the National Festival in Makanda and Scotland. Yeah. Tell us about the reception locally and internationally.
Yeah, it went to Makanda, and then after Makanda, it went to the State Theatre. And then after State Theatre, it went to Edinburgh, which is one of the largest festivals in the world. And, you know, Edinburgh is huge to such an extent that some of the productions barely ever get reviews, you know. So it was an honor and an affirmation, in a sense, for me that a play, unknown actors, unknown history to a large extent, and basically a new production going there, but getting such great reception, they came back with a 4-star rating, you know, which is something very rare to happen. I don't know how many South African productions have gotten a 4-star from Edinburgh before.
And this production was directed by Silo Makekanube.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, after our experience of working together, him acting, I said, because I could see the way he immerses himself in the script, that for me, acting is not just recital, you know. I want them to live that experience. And I thought Brasilo could be good at that. Because for me, he's not just a director. He's also a teacher. You know, he would sit with the guys explaining the history, you know, give the context and make them feel. I mean, he would really, in explaining the story, try to make them feel the atmosphere of the 60s, feel what was happening in the country or the two characters, where they come from. Yep.
Okay, okay. So going back to the stuff that you do on a daily basis, I'm not saying you don't write regularly, of course you do, but to put a bread on the table, you also teach at the University of Johannesburg. Could you tell us about that and how that feeds into your creativity, if it does?
Well, I don't know how it feeds in my creativity as yet because it's pretty new. I started teaching in the second semester. I joined UJ earlier this year, in April this year, mid-semester. So, but it's been quite an exciting journey for me. First of all, I was trained as a teacher. I ran away from it about how many years ago? 20-something years ago, 1998. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and I used to be a tutor at Vates some 20 years ago. So to go back to the classroom now and more confident in what I do and being more deliberate, you know, not because I'm just looking for a job, but it being something because for the years that I've been a writer, I've been doing workshops, I've been interacting with audiences and all the time.
Yes.
And for me to go back to the classroom to teach what I do on a daily basis, I feel like my life is complete.
Wow.
Unlike before that, you know, I've had to separate my work from what I do for fun. So everything now is complete. I feel like I'm cheating. I'm getting paid for doing what I enjoy.
Sure. And in addition to that, you also publish Imbiza Literary Journal. For those who are not familiar with the title, it's called Imbiza. Not the isiZulu version of Imbiza, the one that you use as medicine, okay? Imbiza, as in isiXhosa Imbiza, meaning pot. So the journal is a melting pot of creative ideas. And Imbiza has been going on for how long now?
Well, for almost 2 years now, because we started in the beginning of last year. The idea came up during the lockdown. You know, the lockdown gave one time to think and reflect. And I was like, you know, from time to time, I mean, you release a book and another one and another one. But what legacy are you leaving? You know, and I've written papers where I motivate, you know, the importance of journals, how many writers, you know, emerged through journals.
Yes.
And looking around, there was no such a journal, you know. And we've been bemoaning the fact that, you know, literary journals are not doing well and, you know, hardly survive. And they are not there, you know, the posit of such. So I was like, okay, why don't I come up with this thing, you know, put all the ideas that I have and see how it goes. And it's really exciting. Now I'm working on the fifth version, on the fifth edition. Mm-hmm. Like every edition, you have over 30 writers contributing, some getting published for the very first time. Mm-hmm. And that is the kind of legacy that I would like to leave someday, to say, as a scholar, I published my first article in journal or in Imbiza. I published my first poem, my first short story, or even my first review in such a journal. And it's been really exciting because there's been so much engagement, you know, since we started publishing.
Right, yeah. What you've just said resonates with me. What you've just said about creating a platform for new and upcoming writers, because I'm a beneficiary or a product of that situation program. I was first published in Staff Writer, literary journal. I was 19 years of age. And that gave me, seeing my name in print.
That was 1971.
don't give my age away now. So, I mean, seeing my name in print gave me that confidence. I wasn't even a working journalist by then. I was still a student. It gave me the confidence to say, okay, I can do this thing. So I see the intervention that you're making, and I promise you it will bear fruit, because people need those outlets, because we don't just emerge as this novelist who's we need encouragement, we need criticism, and it starts with smaller pieces, short stories, poems, and academic papers.
Absolutely. And part of my frustration was academic journals. You know, one writes an article today and it will appear 2 years later.
So,
you know, we needed a regular platform. Not that things are microwaved, but you need a platform that publishes more regularly.
Yes. So, yeah, Spiwo, as I said earlier in the introduction, is this multi-talented, multifaceted, all-rounder academic writer, short story. And so his novels include When a Man Cries. That was your first novel.
Yeah, that's right.
And he wrote that in English, and then he self-translated it into Xhosa.
I rewrote it in Xhosa.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, because translation is not accurate, really.
Yeah.
Because it was a different journey altogether. And you've also published numerous collections of short stories. Mm-hmm. And to be fair and honest with you, you are the forerunner in terms of resuscitating the South African short story in South Africa. Because there was a slump with the demise of Staff Writer and those journals. People who were writing short stories got discouraged and moved on to something else, or stopped writing. But then you resuscitated this thing when you published African Delights, and the people said, oh, it's doable. And I was also encouraged by that, and publishers, that's inspired the publishing industry as well to say, no, this genre is not dead; it can be resuscitated.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, When a Man Cries was a series of short stories, and that are interrelated. And I knew at that time that as a new writer, no one was gonna publish my short stories.
A collection of short stories.
Yeah, so I just had to rewrite it and try to connect those stories, and in the end, I made them a novel. So that's one aspect of things. And then African Delights. Now that I was published, publishers were approaching me for new material.
Yes.
And I was working on short story collection. But at the time, most publishers in South Africa had a disclaimer on their websites that we don't publish short stories, yes. Including, by the way, Jacana, who eventually published the collection.
Yes.
So I approached Jacana had approached me before asking if I'm working on anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I said I am. And then I approached them. I said, well, I have this short story collection.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at it, and despite their disclaimer on the website,
yeah, I know.
They accepted it, and yeah. and that set the ball rolling for me. And apparently, it opened the way for many other writers.
Oh yeah, and it inspired a number of local short story competitions. We've got Short Sharp Stories, we've got Africa Day short story competition, and all those are producing new unearthing new talent. And it was a great intervention. Thank you very much. We have here Dr. Spiwo Mahala from the University of Johannesburg, academic, novelist, short story writer, playwright, and publisher of Imbiza Literary Journal, and many other things that I think he might still be cooking in his creative mind. It was a pleasure to be with you, to celebrate your literary journey, and of course congratulate you on these many major achievements that are an inspiration to those of us who love books in South Africa and the African diaspora as a whole.
Well, thank you. I can promise you the pot is full. I'm not cooking anything.
So let's just enjoy his output. His name is Dr. Sipiwo Mahala. Go out there, get his books. They are all over the place. You can buy them online at bookstores. And, of course, the Literary Journal, the latest edition, has got Prazeik Mda on the cover. And so it's a cornucopia of literary food. And I might brag, if I would be allowed to brag on my show, that I was the first person on the cover of Imbiza, the first edition. I'm wearing a suit there.
Yeah, that's when you used to dress up.
No, thank you very much, Sipiwo, and congratulations on your output.
Thanks a lot, Mdungu.
Thank you. Books and Beverages, Fred Khumalo.